Welcome to The Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. Hello, welcome back to another episode of The Victory Kitchen. Today is episode number 20, Head, Heart, Hand, and Health, 4-H Enlists. Now, this is the second episode diving into agriculture during World War II and how that connects to the greater topic of food rationing during the war. It's also exciting because before the pandemic, like I think it was 2019, I had a chance to go to my local historical society in their little research room at the library and do some research looking into 4-H and the county extension records during World War II. And I am so glad I did that because now I think that little research room is closed because of the pandemic. And so I have copies of the pictures that I was able to take, and I was able to use that in today's episode. And this episode is close to my heart because I am a mom of 4-H kids. Now, we are only lightly involved in 4-H. My kids are only, you know, in one club each, and they only carry one project. So I just want to use this chance to give parents and grandparents of 4-H kids a huge pat on the back because it is a lot of work being not only, you know, a 4-H'er as a kid, but as a parent or a grandparent, like ferrying the kids to all their events and, you know, helping them with their projects. And if they have livestock to transport, I mean, it is a big job. And so these parents and grandparents deserve a lot of credit for all of their hard work. And, you know, since we're only lightly involved, I only get just a small taste of that. But I just, you know, from what I've seen of these parents and even the ones that also volunteer their time for 4-H, just I am in awe of these people. So huge round of applause for you guys. Now, some of you might be wondering, what the heck is 4-H? And that's okay, because I feel like unless you're in a rural community, you might not know what 4-H is, and that's fine. And I want to get into that a little bit before we start talking about what 4-H kids did during World War II. So a little bit of the history of 4-H is that A.B. Graham started a youth program in Clark County, Ohio in 1902, which is considered the birth of 4-H in the United States. The first club was called the Tomato Club or the Corn Growing Club. Then T.A. Erickson of Douglas County, Minnesota started a local agricultural after-school clubs and fairs that same year. Then Jesse Field Shambaugh developed the clover pin with an H on each leaf in 1910, and by 1912, they were called 4-H clubs. 4-H is found around the world now in independent country-led programs. You can find 4-H in the U.S., Canada and Mexico, South America, Europe, England, Scotland and Ireland, Southeast Asia, Africa, and Australia. So really, it's everywhere. Now, what does 4-H mean? Because I kind of throw that term around, but what does that mean? It means head, heart, hand, and health. And I'm going to read to you part of the 4-H creed, which explains what those 4-H's mean. It says, I believe in the training of my head for the power it will give me to think, plan, and to reason. I believe in the training of my heart for the nobleness it will give me to be kind, sympathetic, and true. I believe in the training of my hands for the ability it will give me to be helpful, skillful, and useful. I believe in the training of my health for the strength it will give me to enjoy life, to resist disease, and to work efficiently. So this is the creed for 4-H that the children learn while they are, and it's really kind of the foundation of all the projects that they work on while that they are in 4-H. Now, there's also a 4-H pledge, which they usually in 4-H meetings, the kids recite this pledge. It's a little bit different today than it was in World War II. So I wanted to read you what they were saying back then. So in 1927, the pledge read, "I pledge my head to clearer thinking, my heart to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, and my health to better living for my club, my community, and my country." So I think it was maybe about 1960s or 70s that they added "and my world" at the end of that phrase. So it's pretty much the same today, but they added "my world" at the end. So that's kind of a very, in a nutshell, what 4-H was all about. A lot of times it's mostly based in kind of rural communities, but not necessarily. I think it's that way just because a lot of it is kind of rural based projects involving livestock, animals, but there's a lot of projects, especially today, that aren't necessarily involved in livestock. I am going to be talking about the 4-H in the past tense in this episode just because I'm talking about 4-H during World War II. So while I'm talking in past tense, a lot of these things, like about 4-H in general, you know, still applies to 4-H today. So what was 4-H all about? So I want to emphasize that 4-H was more than just showing pigs, cows, and chickens at the county fair. And I think 4-H'ers kind of get fed up with that kind of image of them because they are way more than just, hey, it's those kids that show their animals at the fair. I mean, they were learning and showcasing and teaching valuable skills for use in their lives, in their homes, and in their communities. And in wartime, that was more important than ever. Record keeping was and is something that sets 4-H apart from other organizations for children. Teaching kids the value and importance of keeping records was a big cornerstone of 4-H. So in farming, record keeping is vital in knowing how your farm is doing and in running a good business to show and learn from your progress or failures. It's actually what makes 4-H such a great thing to study during wartime because they kept such great records. Giving demonstrations and presentations was also a big part of 4-H. It helped teach the kids confidence, public speaking, and teaching skills. Within a county, they were organized into clubs based on interest, and in the 1940s, mostly based by gender, from what I noticed. I found some really fun names in the newspapers that I wanted to share with you. I mean, they did have normal names, like based off of like their towns or their neighborhoods, but I really wanted to highlight the fun ones because you know. There was the Milky Way Dairy Club. Hardy, hard, hard. The Old Town Merry Maids 4-H Club. We Feed 'Em Well Pig Club. Cheerful Stitchers and Cookers. Buckskin Ramblers. Come So, spelled K-U-M, So. Cut and So, spelled K-U-T hyphen capital N hyphen S-O. The Country Hostesses, and Wide Awake 4-H Club. I really wonder what their particular focus was. anyway, those are some of the really fun ones I found. During the year, they would choose specific projects to work on, whether it be baking, sewing, canning, or raising a pig, or a production chicken, or a cow, sometimes multiple animals. Now, today, there are many more things like collecting or robotics and art. There's definitely a lot more variety now, but you would learn about your chosen project in your club and at home. You'd keep records of your progress. So if you're canning, you'd keep track of how many quarts and pints you canned and what you canned. If you were raising chickens, you'd keep track of the feed costs, how many eggs the chickens were laying. Along the way, you'd give a demonstration of what you'd been learning, whatever your project happened to be. Nowadays, the kids give the demonstrations to their clubs, but in wartime, they gave the demonstrations to the public as a sort of educational outreach. It's possible that they did give it to their clubs as well, but from what I could tell, like in the newspapers, they gave the demonstrations to the public. I found a newspaper article from the Pentagraph out of Bloomington, Illinois, from November 1943, talking about the Silver Leaf and Old Town Merry Maids 4-H clubs giving a food demonstration. It's entitled 4-H Girls Enlist in Nationwide Food Fights for Freedom Drive. It shows the three girls at the top in a photograph holding three separate dishes, which are these sweet potato dishes that they had prepared. The caption says, three girls from the Old Town Merry Maids 4-H Club helped give food demonstrations Saturday afternoon. They are Betty Jo Lawrence Downs holding creamed sweet potatoes, Margot Geiger holding smashed sweet potatoes in an orange cup, and Patricia Lawrence Downs with a sweet potato pie. And it says that they gave the demonstration in the window of the Union Gas and Electric office. There is an abundance of sweet potatoes, and the government urges everyone to use the foods available now. So the purpose of this particular demonstration was these girls were helping the public find ways of using this abundant food source. So that was their contribution to the community, and it was probably part of a project that they were doing for 4-H. So this was a really cool example. So these demonstrations were not only teaching the kids confidence in public speaking and developing their teaching skills and boosting their self-confidence, but it was also helping them share the knowledge that they'd gained while working on their project with their community. Now, usually the kids' projects would culminate at the county fair where they could show their completed projects, whether it be the chickens, the cows, or the pigs they had raised, the fruit they were canning, the quilt they had sewed, or the bread they had baked, or even clothing that they had sewed, actually. Due to the war, a lot of county fairs were being canceled. Gas and rubber shortages made holding county fairs difficult. But a solution they came up with was to hold just 4-H county club fairs where they were still able to compete. At this time, their projects were judged against one another in their different age groups and categories, and they were given prize ribbons. The different prize ribbons came with cash prizes known as premiums. And during wartime, I saw that some of the prizes were war bonds. So as prizes, the kids were given war bonds. In some cases, the prizes were cookbooks. I saw one girl was given a cookbook called Wartime Cookbook, which there's quite a few cookbooks with that title. So I'm not sure which one she was given. And even some of them were given college scholarships. So I guess it just depended on what had been donated for the 4-H premiums from, you know, companies and people donating. But that's something that the kids were able to earn through their hard work. And after the 4-H County Club Fair, it became an opportunity for the kids to sell their livestock animals. And in wartime, like selling these pigs and cows for meat, you know, that was an especially important part of the process. I also wanted to mention that if the state fairs were running, after the county fair, if they won the grand prizes in any of the categories, the 4-H kids could continue on to the state fair where they could compete for, a greater prize. And so, you know, first you start out at the county level, you compete against other kids in your county, and then at the state fair, all the winners from each counties compete together at the state fair. So that's how that works. Next, I wanted to talk about 4-H in wartime. The activities that 4-H kids had been engaged in before the war moved seamlessly into what Uncle Sam was asking them to do. They were perfectly positioned to do what needed to be done. The organization and teaching for these skills were already in place. So 4-Hers really stepped up to the plate when the government asked the nation's youth for help in doing their part. In the Sunday Journal Star for Lincoln, Nebraska, the 29th of August in 1943, this was the state fair edition of the newspaper, so it is chock full of ads for 4-H and, you know, congratulatory messages from companies for 4-H. It's actually really cool to look through. But there was this particular ad from Consumers Public Power District. It was titled Homefront Commando, and it shows a smiling 4-H boy holding two pigs. And it says, too young to fight? Well, hardly. 4-H club members in Nebraska are fighting their own battle in their own way and are contributing to ultimate victory with as much zeal and patriotism as the commandos, rangers, and marines. Each day they attack at dawn in the battle of food production. Through their efforts and by reason of their skill and methods, they have ably taken the place of thousands of their fighting brothers who are not on the firing line. The 4-H's, head, heart, hand, and health, were conceived long before this present war began and will continue to exist long after victory is achieved. In fact, it is the spirit and the principles embodied in the activities of the 4-H Club Boys and Girls of Free America that will speed the day of victory for a free world. Wow, that's a great ad. Very heavy, heavy propaganda. But I really love this, that they're kind of taking the propaganda spin towards 4-H, though, and that they are showing that these kids are doing their part, that they are the home front commandos, that they get up at dawn and they do this hard work. I love this, that each day they attack at dawn in the battle of food production. So in the research that I was able to do in my local historical society, these county extension reports, there was this chilling introduction. It says, America is at war. The American home front is on a definite wartime basis. Therefore, since homes, agriculture, and all businesses are geared for war, this is a wartime report. The time is abnormal, so no effort has been made to distinguish between normal and war activities. And this was from 1943. The report, it's just giving a report of the county extension activities, including 4-H, with their regular activities. But, you know, interwoven in all these things are the wartime things. And for example, there was a Victory Garden class broadcast on the radio, which when I was rereading it today, it gave me such Zoom virtual class vibes. And it, but 1940s style. That was just kind of a surreal thing to be reading about. Kind of like one of those weird parallel things. Yeah, it just that things were so abnormal, they just didn't even bother making it different. Like, this is just, this is the way things are now. They just kind of were coming to accept it. In the August 1942 Farm Journal, there was a great summary of 4-H activity and how the war was calling them to something bigger. It says, gardens, bigger and healthier and neater than ever, cover the countryside as you speed along the highways or railways. Young girls everywhere are learning how to can fruits, vegetables, and meats, how to eat for vigorous health, how to turn available materials into fashionable dresses, how to entertain on little money and effort, how to dress up a room with a few skillful touches, how to put colors together and get effect, and also how to be a farmhand. Farm boys are busier than ever raising meat animals, baby beeves, swine, lambs, poultry, and grain to feed. They're raising a large part of the food for the family. They're learning what care and maintenance of the farm, its buildings, and its machinery mean. In many counties, 4-H boys have organized rural firefighting departments. This has always been the 4-H program, and the country can be thankful now that this has been so. But due to the urgency of war, 4-H has been further stepped up, vitalized. Victory is not an idle word to them. Food for freedom, victory gardens, salvage campaigns, war bonds, help for their parents in home and field. These are all jobs to these girls and boys, not just talk. And I mean, Farm Journal was definitely pro 4-H, pro anything agriculture for sure. And this is a very passionate article, you know, about 4-H and how much they're doing for the war effort. I really like the sentence that says victory is not an idle word to them. I mean, they were already doing all of these things. And I feel like out of all of the children's organizations in the country, probably 4-H was the one that was most closely aligned and ready to kind of pick up and do what the country needed of what quote unquote Uncle Sam was asking them to do, what needed to be done, because they were already doing it. And all they needed to do was do more, do more of it. Now, I'm going to get into some of these specifics. What exactly were they doing in more detail? A lot of these children had siblings that were going off to war. So they stepped into the breach of brothers enlisting and even sisters joining up to help in the military branches. So they stepped in to do their chores on the farm, caring for animals, doing the milking, delivering the milk, and then other various chores around the farm. There is a story of one girl in the Lincoln Journal Star out of Nebraska from May of 1943, and her name was Donaldine Perriott. She didn't actually have any brothers or sisters in the Army, but due to an injury to her father and a labor shortage, she had been running the tractor all spring, preparing the ground for planting the corn. It was her first time driving the tractor. A neighbor showed her how to do it, and since then she'd been at it steady. The only trouble she encountered was the first day when she killed the engine and she couldn't get the tractor started again. So, really determined girl, and as soon as the neighbor showed her how to do it, she was off and running. 4-H kids also participated in the Food Fights for Freedom drive. In a Kentucky newspaper, I found a pledge card, a 4-H victory pledge card that kids could fill out. And what it was a way that they could pledge their best efforts in following the 4-H victory projects for statewide Food for Freedom program to help win the war. So on the card, it says, "I want to help my country and her allies win this war for freedom. As a way of doing this, I hereby apply for enlistment in the 4-H Club of blank county, Kentucky." This is particularly for Kentucky. Then they fill out their name, their age, the club year, the post office, the years in the club work, their neighborhood. "And I pledge to give my best efforts in the following 4-H victory projects." Then they have to write in the name of their club or the project group, community or district, the parents' name, and their address. And then at the bottom it says, "Kentucky 4-H Club members, 200,000 strong, are enrolling in a great statewide Food for Freedom program to help win the war. By signing this 4-H victory pledge card, a boy or girl can enlist to grow vegetables and crops, raise livestock, can or preserve foods, make clothing, and otherwise work in behalf of victory. Growing seed hemp will be one of the special wartime projects for 4-H Club members. Sign this card and give it to a 4-H Club leader, a neighborhood leader, a county agent, or home demonstration agent or teacher. They will help you enlist in the 4-H wartime program for 1943. So this was a huge campaign for 4-Hers to join. And it was to, you know, increase food production. And this was geared towards kids, but it was just, I'm sure, one arm of this huge national program. They also participated in the National 4-H Soil Conservation Contest. In another newspaper, it says, "A new 4-H contest, which will enlist the membership of 4-H clubs in protecting American farmlands from further disastrous losses of fertile soil, has just been announced. Named the National 4-H Soil Conservation Contest, one of its chief objectives is to prevent soil wastage and deterioration by practicing approved methods of protection and conservation. Special awards for outstanding 4-H records and achievement in the activity have been provided." So this was, it sounds like this was a project that a 4-H kid could carry and work on, and they could earn special awards for that. Then, of course, there were victory gardens that 4-H kids helped to plant at home. They tended them, harvested them, and canned the produce from these home gardens. There was also Victory Farm Volunteers and the U.S. Crop Corps that 4-H kids participated in. And we talked a little bit, I mean, I mentioned it briefly in the last episode about Victory Farm Volunteers. This was an organization that was geared towards high schoolers that was under the U.S. Crop Corps. And this was to enlist high schoolers in helping on local farms. 4-H kids also participated in the National 4-H Safety Activity. This was to bring more safety awareness to local farms. In a Missouri newspaper, they explain what this was all about. It says, the chief objective of this nationwide campaign will be to reduce the appalling number of annual loss of manpower resulting from preventable accidents and of property damaged by fire due to carelessness on farms and in rural communities. Then 4-H members with outstanding records and achievements received awards for their work, including special trips, college scholarships, and war bonds. The article goes on to say, 4-H club members will strive to cut down the tremendous annual toll of 18,500 deaths and 1,500,000 injured in the farm field by conducting actual farm and home surveys and making demonstrations, talks, and exhibits. These rural youths are well qualified for the task as they have conducted individual campaigns to safeguard their own homes with excellent results. And I really liked this article because it really touched on a lot of the foundation of how 4-H functions, about how they do demonstrations and talks and have displays and just really that educational outreach to their homes, their own families, and to communities to teach what they're learning about. And in this case, it's something super important, which is safety on the farm. Farm jobs were extremely dangerous. And if you've ever been to like a county fair, or if you've gone to like a tractor show and you've seen these old farm equipment machinery, I mean, you can see how dangerous these things were, and that they could be dangerous if not handled correctly. And so it's really no joke. So I was not aware of this campaign before doing this research. And this is, I think this was really cool that these youth were involved in this national safety activity. Now, the rest of these activities, I still wanted to touch on, even though it's kind of moving away from the standard like agricultural activities, because I did want to focus mostly on food and agricultural, but I still wanted to talk about these because, like I said at the beginning, not a lot of people know much about 4-H and, you know, what they're all about. And especially people don't know what they did during the war. And so I wanted to touch on the really cool things that they participated in to help with the war effort. One of those things was there was a 4-H fleet of Liberty ships. And I found this information on the 4-H History Preservation website, which I will have a link to this in my resources on my blog. On the website, it says, midway in the war, the Extension Service, in cooperation with the Maritime Commission, worked out a unique incentive to 4-H achievement on the home front. It was proposed that states be permitted to name Liberty ships after a 4-H or Extension pioneer as a reward for bond sales and exceptional service in food production and conservation. In response to the Name a Ship campaign, the state 4-H armies intensified their war activities. Georgia Club members raised almost $10 million in a war bond campaign and produced in one season enough food to fill a 10,000-ton ship. Their ship was launched and duly named Hoke Smith, in honor of the co-sponsor of the Smith-Lever Act, establishing the Extension Service. 4-H boys and girls in Washington State were credited with selling 3,370,000 worth of bonds in a single campaign. Wow. Their Liberty ship was named the E.A. Bryan after the late president of Washington State College. In all, around 50 ships were christened in these 4-H name-a-ship campaigns, and there may well have been more. Funds were raised by 43 states to each name a Liberty ship, and in some states there were more than just one. In the cabin of each ship was placed a plaque stating that the ship was named by 4-H club members of the state, and near the plaque was a history of the man for whom the ship was named, written on parchment and mounted under glass permanently. So that is super cool. And that is something I did not know. They had other fundraisers, so not just for these Liberty ships. They had fundraisers for ambulances, planes like the P-51 Mustangs, bombers, fighter planes, war equipment. They also collected scrap metal and other reusable items. One of the most fascinating things they collected was milkweed pods for using the floss for life jackets. I grew up in Indiana where milkweed pods were everywhere. I love those things because when they dry out, you can crack them open. The seeds are attached to these little silky white fluffy things that help them kind of fly away in the breeze. But they're so soft and fuzzy, and they're really fun to play with as a kid. But I did not realize that they used the floss for life jackets. And during the war, like I think the original stuff that they used for life jackets came from overseas, and so it was difficult to get. So instead, they enlisted 4-H kids to collect these milkweed pods. And according to the February 1945 issue of National 4-H Club News, 4-H girls and boys had collected enough milkweed pods to make 1 million life jackets, a total of 2.5 million bushel bags, and they were still collecting. Wow, that's amazing. They also held war bond drives and other fundraisers. They did all kinds of stuff. 4-H'ers really did their part of stepping into the fight on the home front. They went above and beyond, living up to their pledge of larger service for their community and their country. Some final thoughts that I had were, as I was doing research, I was thinking about, you know, where were the minorities in these 4-H groups. In my search through the newspapers, I didn't see any pictures of minorities. Even in my search with the National Archives, I didn't come across very much. But what I did come across were two photographs of girls. They were making bread, and the caption was, "Girl in 4-H Cooking Display." And they were from the Red Lake Band of Chippewa from Minnesota in 1941. I did not realize that Native tribes were involved in 4-H, so I was very fascinated by this, but that's about all I could find. There's a lot of documents in the National Archives, but a lot of them I don't have access to. But the 4-H Preservation website does have a page dedicated to the history of Native Americans and their involvement in 4-H. And I will be leaving that link on my blog for you to use as further research if you'd like. When it comes to other minority groups like African Americans or even the poor, I'm not sure, you know, how, you know, equal it was when it comes to 4-H. I was just thinking about other agricultural groups that might have been excluded were sharecroppers or people who were poor or migrant workers. You know, they wouldn't have necessarily the transportation to go to meetings or things like that. Definitely would require a lot more research. But when it comes to this time period, when I'm doing research, it's easy to just take what's given to me and what I find, and to not necessarily think beyond that in what I'm not finding. And so I'm trying to be more conscientious of that and asking, you know, more questions about why am I not finding specific groups of people. And it's not to say that there were not minority groups participating in 4-H. It's just I have not found that in my research yet. And since I only have a few weeks to do my research, I'm sure there is much more that I'm not finding. And so if there are, you know, more resources out there that you're aware of, please do let me know, because I would love to learn more about this topic. Today's cookbook feature is the Wartime Cookbook. This particular cookbook doesn't have an author per se, but it was edited by Ruth Burlzheimer. And she has edited so many cookbooks from this time period. I think she's famous for the Culinary Arts Institute books. There's so many of those. Just a plethora of them. So if you run across one of those, she's probably the one that edited them from this time period up through the 50s and 60s and before that, even in the 30s. So, but this is a special edition. This one has an eagle on the front, and it has a subtitle, Nothing Counts But Victory. I think this was meant to be a series, the Victory series, but I have not come across any other copies for this series. So maybe this ended up being the only one. I'm not sure. Or maybe there's other ones floating around out there. But this is a really special book. It has a lot of great recipes. But I picked this cookbook especially for this episode because at the very beginning, there's a page of acknowledgments. And it says, we gratefully acknowledge the generous assistance of the organizations listed below. They placed at our disposal vast reservoirs of information and illustrations, facilitating our efforts in the production of these books. And among all of these organizations, including the U.S. Army, Navy, Marines, U.S. Office of Education, the Campfire Girls, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Life Magazine, so many, even some universities, there's also 4-H clubs. And this is the only cookbook I have that makes mention of the 4-H clubs. So I thought, hey, this was perfect for this episode. It doesn't have a publication date, but I am placing it at 1942 because in the introduction, it talks about how sugar is rationed now and other foods are likely to be restricted. It doesn't talk about coffee rationing. And so that's why I'm guessing this is really right up at the beginning of the war where it's just sugar. It's got some great photographs in here. And this issue is interesting because the photographs focus mostly on the Red Cross, which I find interesting. So maybe the Red Cross just donated a lot of photographs. I don't know. But that's really great. Now, the two recipes I tried kind of go together. I tried cornmeal griddle cakes because I wanted to try something grain related for no reason in particular. And also mostly because I was tired of making my family regular pancakes. I wanted to try something different. And I'll talk about the second recipe in just a second. But so the cornmeal griddle cakes. Now, I don't know if you've made cornmeal griddle cakes before. This recipe has cornmeal, sugar, salt, and 2 cups boiling water, 1.5 cups of milk. And I'm giving you the liquid measurements because that comes into play in just a second. It has 1 cup cornmeal, 1 cup flour, and then baking powder, eggs, shortening. So kind of a standard pancake recipe, except that there's the cornmeal in there. Now, when I made these, you pour the boiling water over the cornmeal. And this is actually a really important step because the boiling water cooks the cornmeal and that's really good. This actually makes it nice and soft. And so the corn texture isn't as apparent when you eat these griddle cakes. I thought it was really nice. You still have that corn taste, but not necessarily the, you know, gritty feeling in your teeth. But I feel like the liquid to dry measurements were way off. The 2 cups water and the 1.5 cups of milk, 3.5 cups of liquid to 2 cups of dry is just not right. And nothing I did seemed to help this except add more flour. And so I feel either do 1 cup of boiling water to 1 cup of cornmeal and leave the milk as it is, or 2 cups of boiling water and just 1/2 cup of milk. So either way, you got to reduce the liquid somehow. So, I mean, I'm going to, you know, give you the recipe on my blog. I'll leave you to play with it as you like. But somehow reduce that liquid by a cup at least, because I just had to keep adding flour. And of course, that affects the recipe. Like, it's not going to rise the same. They tasted just fine, but they were definitely on the flat side. I still have some sitting in my fridge right now as we speak. They weren't a favorite with the family. I mean, they liked them when they were fresh and hot, but the longer they sit in the fridge, the less appealing they are, I guess. So, yeah, that's that recipe. Super easy. I mean, they're just griddle cakes. I like them. I think they had a really nice taste and texture. My kids seemed to like them, and my 4-year-old was going around walking, like, just eating them plain, which always makes me happy. I don't care if you put anything on it. But actually, the reason why I made them was to put on the next recipe on top, and that was apple butter. I wanted to pay tribute to the canning efforts of 4-H'ers, which we will go more into for the story highlight. But as you know from the canning episode, I never advocate for you guys to try wartime canning recipes. A quick little recap as to why not to use vintage or wartime canning recipes is because there's been a lot of scientific advances between the 1940s and today. What's understood about foodborne bacteria is much better now, and following the correct scientific guidelines will ensure a safe home product. The best place for recipes are your local University Extension Service or the Ball Canning Company. I know it's sad not to be able to use vintage recipes, especially in this aspect of wartime cooking, but since these foods sit on shelves for a while, I think modern science always wins in my book. So please stick to modern approved recipes from safe sources, because even not all modern recipes are necessarily deemed safe. If you'd like to follow a really fun account for safe canning practices, I want to give a shout out to my friend Anna Cash at Smart Home Canning on Instagram. She's got really great resources, some fun recipes, and she's just a really fun gal. So when it came to this ration recipe, this was my solution. I wanted to try this apple butter recipe from this cookbook, but I obviously didn't want to can it. So what I did was I cut it down to just make a pint's worth so I could keep it in my fridge. And it worked. It totally worked. And so I was very excited. I wrote down the measurements just for you. And I was very excited that it was successful. Reduction. because the original recipe calls for like 8 pounds of apples, 2 pounds of brown sugar. Like, no, that's not going to work. Okay. So the cut down recipe is 2 pounds of apples, which isn't very much, 1/2 cup of brown sugar, and then 1/2 teaspoon of allspice, cloves. It depends on how much you like cloves. I'd say 1/4 teaspoon to 1/2 teaspoon of cloves, and then 1 teaspoon cinnamon. Now, when it says in the recipe, 1 tablespoon each of allspice and cloves. And when I cut that down, it was 3/4 teaspoon of allspice and cloves. But the problem with that is 3/4 teaspoon of cloves is enough to make your tongue go numb. So I found that out the hard way. So my apple butter is quite the experience. I do not recommend that experience for you though. So yeah, maybe keep that to 1/4 teaspoon. And it's very simple. And if you have a fancy tool like a stick blender, that actually does come in handy for this recipe. If you don't, you can press the cooked apples through a sieve, but all you do is you select your tart apples, you wash them, remove any blemishes, but don't remove the skins or the cores. You cut your apples into quarters, cover with water, just enough to cover them. And then you cook slowly until the apples are tender. And then you press through a sieve to remove the cores, seeds, and skins. Now, I ran my pulp through one of my Foley strainer mixer things. It's like these vintage sieves that you crank. But it was not as smooth. It didn't end up as smooth as I like apple butter to be. And so once I had run it through there, I did end up using my stick blender to make it even smoother. So that's why I said the stick blender can come in handy, but it's not necessarily, you don't necessarily have to have it. So after you have your pulp, you put it back in a pot and you cook until thick enough to mound on the spoon. That just means you need to reduce it, like to remove enough of the liquid, but don't let it burn. You add sugar and spices and cook until thick, stirring frequently. And then you put it in your little jar and you stick it in your fridge and enjoy. On Instagram, I asked how people like to enjoy their apple butter, because I like to have it on a peanut butter sandwich. Yum. And I also learned to enjoy this when I used to do Civil War reenacting. Somebody had made fried biscuits. Well, just like those refrigerated canned biscuits out of the refrigerated section. They fried them up and you just eat that with apple butter. Oh my gosh, that is heavenly. But some other people suggested eating apple butter on ham, which sounds really good. A friend of mine said that she likes apple butter stirred into her cottage cheese. Someone else said they liked it on their cinnamon pancakes, which I think sounds so delightful. Yum. Besides putting it on ham, someone else suggested putting it on grilled pork chops or pork roast. You could mix it into barbecue sauce. There's so many ways to enjoy this stuff. And I will have the recipes for the apple butter and the cornmeal griddle cakes, along with pictures, on my blog, victorykitchenpodcast.com. Today's story highlight comes from the June 1943 issue of Farm Journal and Farmer's Wife magazine. It's an article entitled 4-H Canners Jump Into the Fight by Beth Cummings. It's got the three pictures of these girls doing their work. One is harvesting, one is taking canned produce down into her cellar, and another girl is selling her canned produce at a nearby market. And this article is amazing. Like, just what these gals have done is mind-blowing. It says, the Produce and Preserve for Others campaign, launched by Farm Journal and Farmer's Wife magazine in the April issue, gives farm girls their biggest opportunity to help produce food to win the war. Fathers and mothers can't do it all. Many of them are going to have a tough job just keeping the farm going. This is the chance girls have been asking for, and judging by their record so far, they're going to jump at it. They produced a record amount of food in 1940, broke that record in 1941, set still a new one in 1942, 14 million quarts of food, and are set to post an even higher record this summer. Take the Texas 4-H girls, for example. Last year, they and their mothers put up enough meat, vegetables, and fruit to feed every one of the 300,000 Texas men in the armed services for 3 months. This year, they will try to feed those 300,000 soldiers for 6 months. Other states are working just as hard. Feed our fighters has become a 4-H battle cry the country over. Some of this food preservation will be done in community canneries. The Sedgwick 4-H Club girls in Bell County, Texas, canned each Thursday last year in a store operated by their club sponsor. Monticello, Georgia, has a community cannery in which farm women and girls canned for 800 school children, 22,000 number two cans, last year. A club in Surry County, North Carolina, put up thousands of cans in their school to be used by all schools in the county. Of course, even more food will be canned by girls in their own kitchens. It is one of the best ways for them to pick up some extra money and at the same time do something patriotic. Everything they put up beyond their family's needs will find a ready market if they have a quality product. Louise White, 15-year-old Georgia farm girl, whom I visited recently, has one of the most remarkable records I have come across. She canned over 3,000 jars of food last year with her mother, plus 2,000 cans by herself, much of which was sold. Mary Ellen Red and Helen Phillips, South Carolina 4-H Club members, sell at the Aiken Home Demonstration Market. Since the girls are neighbors, they like to do their heavy canning together. They and their mothers set up a regular assembly line. But you don't have a public market like this? Neither did Irene Melvin, North Carolina. But for several years, she has had her own special customers. Maybe you could too if you start now. In Emanuel County, Georgia, each boy and girl has pledged to raise a ton of food this summer, about enough to feed a fighter for a year. Members of the Copeland 4-H Club, acclaimed the best in North Carolina for several years, held an emergency meeting when they saw their school garden cut by a dry spell. They went home and planted something extra in their own gardens. Then, when canning time came, they put up 8,008 jars of fruits and vegetables in the school cannery and stocked their school pantries. Georgia 4-H members will sponsor a 10,000-ton Liberty ship, $2 million in war bonds, and produce food to fill that ship. These are just a few of the stories of action led by teenage homefront soldiers. It is being duplicated in every state, in growing food, canning and drying food, selling food. Why don't you do it too? It's your chance to get into the fight for food. Wow. this article just blew me away. Especially Louise White, who canned with her mother over 3,000 jars and then also on her own canned 2,000 jars. Wow. I can't even, oh man. I mean, I'm proud of myself if I can like 32 jars of food in 1 year. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And it's just, I love this heartwarming story of the Copeland 4-H Club that they held this emergency meeting when their school garden was cut by a dry spell. And so they went home and planted extra in their own home gardens and then came back and canned all that food and stocked their school pantries. I just love that. That is so awesome. It just shows how these 4-H kids, you know, did so much, not just for their own families, but for their communities and also for their country. They did some pretty awesome stuff, don't you think? Well, that's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for joining me. If you or your family have any American Homefront stories, I would love to be able to share them on my podcast. To share your story, go to victorykitchenpodcast.com and click on Share a Homefront Story. We have lots of fun on Instagram, so come on over and give me a follow. My handle is Victory Kitchen Podcast, and I would love your support, which keeps this podcast going. To do so, go to anchor.fm/Victory Kitchen Podcast and click on support. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.